Good evening. The census question on citizenship reaches the Supreme Court, New York City's own Green New Deal, and Brazilian indigenous people at the United Nations protesting their president, the Trump of Brazil. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2019. The justices of the United States Supreme Court appear split along ideological lines on whether a citizenship question can be included on forms for the upcoming 2020 census. Observers say, based on their questions during Tuesday's oral arguments at the High Court, the justices appear ready to vote 5-4 to allow the Trump administration to add the hotly contested questions to forms for next year's national headcount. The liberal justices, led by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, almost immediately began peppering the Trump administration's attorney, U.S. Solicitor General Noel Francisco, with questions after the arguments were underway, criticizing the administration's justification for the question. There's no doubt that people will respond less to the census if it includes the question, Sotomayor said. Justice Elena Kagan noted that the record of evidence for the case shows the need for citizenship question is a contrived one. The conservative side of the bench, however, pointed to the discretion of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau. Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Neil Gorsuch nodded to the history of the U.S. Census, asking questions about citizenship status in the past. In multiple lawsuits brought by dozens of states, cities, and other groups, three federal judges at U.S. district courts have issued rulings blocking the administration's plan for the question. It asks, is the person a citizen of the United States? All three judges in New York, California, and Maryland ruled that Ross's decision to include the question violated procedures for adding new census questions under administrative law. The judges in California and Maryland have also ruled that adding the question is unconstitutional because it hurts the government's ability to carry out the constitutional mandate for a once-a-decade headcount of every person living in the United States. The director of the census count in New York City is Julie Menon. She says if there is an undercount, New York City services will suffer.
First of all, I want to thank the Attorney General's office. I want to thank the ACLU and all the plaintiffs. The City of New York was also a plaintiff in this case. And it is so important what happened today. We have to make sure that the citizenship question is off of the census. In New York City, we are a city of 3.2 million immigrants. We have so much at stake. We're fighting for our share of over $800 billion of federal funds that are allocated to cities and states across the country for public education, for public housing. The risk of an undercount to cities that have large immigrant populations is so dire, and that is why we're standing here today.
In the current political climate, Census Bureau research indicates the question is likely to discourage households with non-citizens, including unauthorized immigrants, from taking part in the count. The Bureau estimates 6.5 million people will not respond to the 2020 census themselves if a citizenship question is included. That estimate might climb higher after the agency conducts its first field test of the question on a 2020 census form beginning in June. New York Attorney General Letitia James was joined by Representative Carolyn Maloney outside the Supreme Court today. She said the census question would deny communities their proper representation.
When those in power commit unlawful acts, we will hold them accountable for their actions. And that is why we stand before you today, before this venerable court. I want to be crystal clear. I believe that this case should be decided on the merits of the arguments and according to the letters of the law. I also strongly believe that the facts and the records support our claims, and I am hopeful that the honorable justices will agree. But at the same time, we cannot afford to recognize that at the heart of this matter, there is more at issue than just surveys and statistics, because the census is more about just an accurate count. It's about how our government is organized and how our power is equally divided. It's also about the equal distribution of funds. Fundamentally, the census is a measure we use to deliver on one of our nation's core tenets, and that is the promise of fairness. And fairness means that assistance reaches those who need it the most. It means that communities have an equal representation in government. It means that no group or neighborhood is marginalized. And for this reason, it is imperative that we challenge the addition of the citizenship question to the 2020 census, and that the 2020 census be accurate. Adding that particular citizenship question could lead to the undercounting in communities across America, particularly in immigrant communities and Hispanic communities. It would mean that communities entitled to resources wouldn't get those resources. It would deny certain communities of equal representation. And so in the interest of fairness, in the interest of upholding this quintessential American promise, we are obligated to ensure the most accurate count in the 2020 census. And as such, we must use every tool at our disposal, in our arsenal, to fight to protect its integrity. And that's what we did today. I'm so grateful and humbled to fight alongside such talented and insightful colleagues each and every day. And now we'd like to hear from Mr. Ho.
Thank you much, Attorney General James. It's an honor to work with your team. I just want to make one thing clear. This case, this question, are you a citizen? It's not about a line on a form. It's about whether or not everyone in America counts. The government's own estimate is that putting this question on the census is going to cause 6.5 million people not to respond. They're just going to vanish from our nation's population count. Just to put that in perspective, it would be at like if our 18th largest state just went poof. It will so severely damage the accuracy of the census that six states are at risk of losing a seat in the House of Representatives: California, Florida, Texas, Arizona, Illinois, and of course New York. It's critically important. It's a pillar of our constitutional structure to get the count right. Today's argument is the first step in that, because no matter what the court decides, it's on all of us to make sure that the census is accurate next year and that every community receives the representation and the resources that it's entitled to. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
What's the risk? What's the risk of people not signing this form?
There is a significant risk. I mean, all of the data suggests and all of the experts suggest, even from Department of Justice as well as the Census Bureau, that it will undermine the count and will dramatically impact those. Citizenship question would clearly undermine the state of New York and other states that have a significant number of immigrants and particularly Hispanic communities.
Why don't you just encourage people who may be in this country illegally to go ahead and sign the census to admit that they are not citizens of this country if you want an accurate count? What do you fear from that?
Justice Sotomayor asked the question, do you believe that Latinos and others who may be undocumented, do they have a fear for filling this out and showing that they are undocumented? And there is a real fear among people. We need to take that fear away because everyone needs to be counted.
If there's illegality in revealing that they are here illegally, if there is illegality in using the census for some nefarious purpose, you can answer that question too, sir.
Well, she asked that. You ask an undocumented in your neighborhood why they may fear. They're afraid. But I tell you, I am for following the law. Everyone should fill it out. Everyone should fill out the census form. That's what I think.
If I could address that question, everyone should, of course, fill out the census. There's a legal obligation to do so. But the Census Bureau has for decades opposed adding this question because the statisticians have done the research and they've discovered that if you add it, we're going to get fewer people responding to the census and a less accurate census. And let's not forget what the administration's purpose is here. They say they want to publish block by block counts of citizens and non-citizens. Well, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to be concerned that if that data is out there, it could pose a risk to you. We've seen an administration that is picking people up in sensitive places like courthouses, schools, going to the doctor's office, a man driving his pregnant wife who's in labor to a hospital. So I think it's quite understandable that people would be concerned about that. What I hope is that people will still fill out the census, but there's no real dispute about whether or not this question is going to wreck the census because the government has admitted it.
Now, any questions?
Can you take two more questions here?
Hispanics are
excuse me. Right there.
And the Census Bureau says it needs a final ruling on whether to include a citizenship question by June in order for the printing of paper forms for the census to begin this summer as scheduled. But a recent Fourth Circuit appeal by plaintiffs in one of the Maryland lawsuits who are challenging a ruling on racial discrimination claims could complicate the timeline. If Congress provided additional funding, the Bureau could extend its June deadline for finalizing census forms to as late as October 31st. The Bureau's chief scientist testified before the New York trial That would, however, put more pressure on the headcount, which is set to officially begin in January 2020 in remote Alaska before rolling out to the rest of the country by April. And the New York City Council, ahead of Earth Day, passed groundbreaking climate legislation, including the largest mandated pollution reduction in any city in the world. The New York Climate Mobilization Act is actually a suite of 10 bills, most notably the landmark Dirty Buildings Law. The bill, introduced by New York City Councilman Costa Costanides, mandates that New York's tallest building, those over 25,000 square feet, will need to slash their emissions through energy-efficient building upgrades. This targets New York City's surprising worst polluter, skyscrapers, while also creating thousands of jobs in design, renovation, and construction. The executive director of the New York City Environmental Alliance is Eddie Batista. While he supports the bill, he says there are weaknesses and parts of the legislation he opposes.
There are initiatives that we've actually been partnering with the city, both the Blasio administration and city council, for a couple of years now that we wholeheartedly support, like the Climate Mobilization Act that passed last week that targets the 70% of the city's greenhouse gases that are generated from the building sector. That's actually a bill that we first tried to pass 10 years ago. Only to go down in flames because of the opposition from the real estate industry. We support congestion pricing. That's really more of a state issue, but the city of New York stands to benefit overwhelmingly from that kind of system. And we also support the mayor's commercial waste zone, reform of the commercial waste industry. But there are a couple of areas that gave us pause and a couple of areas that we had some actual opposition to. One is the issue of carbon neutrality and emissions trading for buildings. The other is what we thought was missed opportunity to really address the city's heat plan, which we feel has some holes in them, and the more equitable need to fund coastal protection on the heels of the mayor's announcement of $500 million, the intent to spend for coastal protection for Lower Manhattan and Wall Street. I thought, you know, was really again, a missed opportunity to identify disproportionately vulnerable communities that are getting no coastal protection investment at all.
Now, what about the stuff you oppose, like carbon neutrality? I mean,
part of the problem is both the mayor and the governor are promoting carbon neutrality. So it's not like either one of them is, you know, an innocent party here, right? The mayor clearly is part of his plan. Yesterday announced a way to get to 100% was, you know, a vehicle that or an approach that includes carbon neutrality. And same thing with the governor. I mean, look at the governor's Climate Leadership Act, the CLI, Climate Leadership Initiative. There are pieces of it that clearly talks about carbon neutrality, right? And you know, right now, if you ask some of the big green groups that are allies of the governor, ask them what they think of carbon neutrality being, and what but the response is, you know, there are some industrial sectors that are going to have a really hard, maybe next to impossible pathway to get to 100% emissions reduction. So a way to get there would be through, you know, offsets or through some form of carbon neutrality. So, you know, we keep asking the governor's office and the large green groups, well, what do you mean by carbon neutrality? Because when we've seen carbon neutrality, it's meant offsets. And we've not gotten a straight answer from them yet, but that will be one of the key negotiating points over the Climate and Community Protection Act, which is what New York Renews has been fighting for the last 3 years.
What does that mean exactly?
So offsets is a system where if you're a polluter and you cannot meet a mandate of a certain emissions reduction level, you find an alternative compliance mechanism to get there, right? So what that's meant in, say, a cap and trade system is that, you know, you are, you know, as a polluter, are given a certain amount of credits to pollute. And what you do is, you know, there's an ability to trade those credits on the market system so that some polluters buy another entity's excess pollution credits, and they use that to keep polluting, right? You're adding up the entire carbon footprint of a city or a state, and you're able then to say, look, we are reducing our carbon footprint, we're reducing our greenhouse gas emissions as a whole in total, right? But the communities where the polluter buys credits to continue polluting, to increase their pollution or to maintain their excessive pollution levels. Ask that community if they're seeing any reduction or in public health negative outcomes, or if their asthma rates are improving or whatever, right? Even though the person who sold the credit is polluting less, but maybe they're polluting less in a different jurisdiction, they're polluting less in a community that's not a community of color or a community that's low income. So that for us is, offsets have been traditionally a system where environmental justice or climate justice communities continue to bear the brunt of the cumulative exposure of clustered pollution impacts, where in other communities see reductions.
The coastal protection, for example, on Lower East Side now, along the East River Park, there's a plan, a huge change in the plan that had already been worked out for many years with the community. It's got everybody worked up now basically put this new plan into place, and you have to accept it or you're going to lose everything.
From our perspective, we've always said that for coastal protection, you need more green infrastructure. You need more. So there's the mechanism itself of how they are, what constitutes coastal protection. But for us, it's an even more fundamental problem, which is which communities are you prioritizing, right? Now, you have the mayor who announced a half-billion-dollar coastal protection plan for Lower Manhattan, but you've got the South Bronx, specifically the Hunts Point waterfront, that's been asking, begging, cajoling for coastal protection since Sandy. And there has been no investment for coastal protection. There's some money set aside for a study, but no actual investment of coastal protection. And when you look at the fact that the Hunts Point food market is on the Hunts Point waterfront, and the 23 million people in the region, the tri-state region, depend on that market for their basic food, for meat, for produce, and the fact that there's no protection from flooding or storm surge for that facility is deeply troubling, right? So even if you don't care about the vulnerability of low-income communities and communities of color, especially when they are living in or adjacent to heavy polluting infrastructure uses, so therefore compounding the risk exposure, then care about your breadbasket for the region. Like, care about the ability to maintain and protect the food supply. One of the things that we found out in Sandy was had high tide coincided with Landy sandfall for the Long Island Sound, which surrounds the South Bronx and the Hunts Point waterfront. That means if it would have flooded, and the storm surge would have impacted the markets, and it would have disrupted our food supply, and nobody knows for how long. So there's a question for us of misplaced priorities and not recognizing the public health vulnerabilities that some communities, and in fact the broader region, faces with this emphasis on Lower Manhattan and Wall Street at the exclusion of other equally or more compelling priorities.
And that was Eddie Batista, executive director of the New York City Environmental Alliance. City officials insist carbon offsets will not impact poor areas of the city. They say buildings will be able to buy offsets for the last 10% of the reductions they have to make, but they can do it by purchasing clean power, which currently is 50% more expensive than regular electricity. The city's plans for coastal resiliency are currently being debated by local community boards in the East Village and Lower Manhattan. As New York City faces a worsening homelessness crisis, a new poll from WIN, formerly Women in Need, and Harris X reveals that New Yorkers strongly agree, 92%, that more needs to be done to combat the homelessness crisis. And more than 9 in 10 residents, 92% as well, believe that we should provide shelter to all those who need it. A majority of New Yorkers, 59%, would support a homeless shelter opening in their own neighborhood. Harris X surveyed 1,002 adult New Yorkers from every borough. Results showed broad support for solutions that could help homeless and formerly homeless New Yorkers break the cycle of homelessness. 90% of New Yorkers support providing aftercare for families leaving homeless shelters, and 80% support increasing the value of rent vouchers to cover the cost of housing. While New Yorkers overwhelmingly believe New York City needs to do more, the survey also revealed that most hold a number of misconceptions about who the homeless actually are. While families with children represent over 70% of New York City's homeless population, most New Yorkers believe that the city's homeless are primarily single adults. That's 62%. And while a majority of residents, 65%, assume that having a job is enough to prevent homelessness, the reality is that one in three homeless families have a working adult member. Additional findings show that New York City residents believe that tough times, rather than personal choices and actions, account for why most of the city's homeless population are homeless. That's 55% of the total. And
we're gonna rise like the water. We're gonna shut Bolsonaro.
This is World Indigenous Peoples Day at the United Nations, and groups of Native people from throughout the world are attending. But one group, Brazilian Indigenous people, were at Brazil's consulate on 3rd Avenue Tuesday to protest Brazil's right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, who they call the Trump of Brazil. He has reopened the Amazon rainforest, a massive development. Osprey Oreo Lake represents Women's Earth Climate Network. She says Indigenous people are the ones who own the land where the resources are found.
It is absolutely essential that people all over the world understand that Indigenous peoples, Indigenous rights are under attack. And right now, the big focal point is in Brazil. But we also know these struggles have been going on because of colonization for over 500 years. And now this crisis that has led to attacks on Indigenous rights, where the last of the fresh water is, the last of the forests, the last of what people call the natural resources, which I don't even like that word because it's not natural resources. It's living beings of the forest, the water, the air, the mountains. And this is what Indigenous peoples have been telling us for hundreds of years, to respect the land, to respect Mother Earth, to respect living in harmony with nature, to have a different worldview, that we respect the rights of Mother Earth, that she has rights, that our future generations need fresh water, they need forests, they need a clean climate, they need clean air. And how are we going to have that if we destroy the land? And right now, 80% of all of the biodiversity left on Earth, guess where that is? In the hands and lands of Indigenous peoples. So you can see that their worldview and way of living in respect to Mother Earth has brought about the fact that this is where the water is, the forests, the animals, the plants that we need is in fact, the areas where Indigenous peoples are caretaking the land and have for millennium on their land. So we need to also start seeing this relationship between colonization, environmental racism, attack on Indigenous peoples, and our economic system based on capitalism.
A small group of Indigenous Brazilians and their supporters made an attempt to deliver a 12,000 signature petition to officials within the consulate.
Que o agronegócio está mandando no país e que os povos precisam de respeito.
Só vou traduzir
o mundo precisa
aqui.
Saber.
Okay. She just said that from tonight on, they're going to march in Brasilia, the whole indigenous peoples together are going to march to ask for their rights. So it's called free land camping. So they're going to be at Acampamento Terra Livre and invite the whole planet to join them.
And there was some fear that that gathering tonight in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, might be met with violence. There's been a promise of violence by the Brazilian government, and we'll be watching that very closely here at WBAI. Leila Salazar-Lopez of Amazon Watch says it's not enough to come out once a year on Earth Day. It's time for people to get involved to help Indigenous people throughout the world.
Our actions don't end with a petition signature. Our actions don't end with a protest. Our actions don't end at the UN on May 3rd. Our actions don't end at Terra Livre. Our actions must continue every day. And while we celebrated Earth Day yesterday and we celebrate Earth Week, we all know that it's not just one day or one week, it's every day. We must stand to defend Mother Earth. And We have to take action for who's responsible for this. Do you all know who's responsible for this? Bolsonaro, yes. Someone said that. Yes, it is. He is proud to call himself the Trump of the tropics. And like Trump, he has incited hatred and racism and given permission for people to do horrible things and governments to do horrible things. And we're not going to stand for that. We are going to stand with indigenous peoples of Brazil, with civil society of Brazil, to defend rights, lives, and democracy, and the Amazon, and the climate. And when I say who's responsible, it's not just one person, it's not just Bolsonaro, and it's not just the Brazilian government. Bolsonaro came to the United States, went to the World Economic Forum. What did he say? Let's open up the Amazon for development. And who lined up to do that? Industry, agribusiness. The Brazilian government is run by agribusiness. And this week, we're actually going to be releasing a report to disclose who's responsible, who these ruralistas are connected to, because they have names and faces. And we're going to call them out. And we're going to call them out, and we're going to expose them. And they're companies that you know. They're not just the ruralistas that are in Congress in Brazil or out in farms in the Cerrado or in the Amazon. They're companies that are connected here in the United States, in Europe, and they're banks. Big banks like Bank of America and Wells Fargo, and asset managers like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street. These companies are complicit in the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, and therefore they will be complicit if there is any blood dropped.
Leila Salazar Lopez of Amazon Watch. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 23rd, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.